Hello, John Dennis here on Friday the 20th of March. Today, Barack Obama on a TV chat show. He tells Americans he'll reform Wall Street.
We're going to do everything we can to see if we can get these bonuses back. But I think the most important thing that we can do is make sure that we put in a bunch of financial regulatory mechanisms to prevent companies like an AIG holding the rest of us hostage.
Also today, Joseph Fritzl begins a life sentence. He'll be in a psychiatric institution for the rest of his days.
The authorities again allowed him to go ahead and foster and adopt the children without questioning whether he really was the right person for this, and indeed checking out whether his story was real.
And the former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson looks back at his remarkable life.
I'm sure there's more to my life I'll find out and get to learn about, but at this particular stage right now, I'm pretty cool.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, it's Sandy Waugh with the news and the papers.
At the opening of the European summit in Brussels, Germany has refused to spend any more money to stimulate the economy. This is a blow to Gordon Brown, who was hoping to agree a new programme in time for the G20 meeting in London. However, the European leaders did agree to make nearly £50 billion available to help countries having difficulty with their balance of payments. The National Audit Office says Northern Rock went on lending for risky mortgages 6 months after it was bailed out. The bank had to be nationalised to save it from collapse. The NAO said that nationalising the bank was the right thing to do to protect taxpayers' interests, but it criticises ministers for being slow to act. The International Monetary Fund says the world economy is going to shrink by 1% this year, which is the first time it's happened in 60 years. It says the two countries likely to be worst hit are Britain and Japan. In the USA, the Senate is to consider legislation to strip the executives at the insurance giant AIG of their bonuses. The company had to be bailed out to save it from bankruptcy, but it appears it's still paying out millions of dollars in bonuses. The lower house of Congress passed the law to take 90% of that money back. President Barack Obama's made an unprecedented TV appeal to Iran to make peace. In an address wishing people through the Middle East a happy Nevruz holiday celebration, he spoke directly to the Iranian leadership.
I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community. This process will not be advanced by threats. We seek instead engagement that is honest and grounded in mutual respect. You too have a choice. The United States wants the Islamic Republic of Iran to take its rightful place in the community of nations. You have that right, but it comes with real responsibilities. And that place cannot be reached through terror or arms, but rather through peaceful actions that demonstrate the true greatness of the Iranian people and civilization. And the measure of that greatness is not the capacity to destroy. It is your demonstrated ability to build and create.
Barack Obama, and we'll hear more of him on a TV chat show shortly. Football, and Manchester City got through to the quarterfinal of the UEFA Cup last night, which means both Manchester sides are still in European competition. It was even scores at the end of the second leg last night in City's match against Aalborg, 2-2 on aggregate, so it went to a penalty shootout, and City's new goalie Shay Given won the match for them with two crucial saves. In the morning papers, there are still more pictures of Liam Neeson, the actor whose wife Natasha Richardson died after a skiing accident. A broken man, the Sun calls him. Tearful Liam home after Natasha dies. While the Mirror also shows her actress sister Jolie and mother Vanessa under a headline, A Family's Agony. However, the Austrian father who imprisoned and raped his daughter for 24 years, Joseph Fritzl, also gets onto the front pages. Fritzl jailed for life, says the Times, while the Sun goes further with evil dad caged for life, calling him a cellar monster. The Independent reports even its own soldiers are beginning to attack Israel for killing civilians unnecessarily in its recent attack on Gaza. Israel's dirty secrets, the paper calls the stories. Army veterans reveal how they gunned down innocent Palestinian families and destroyed homes and farms. Finally, the Financial Times has a big picture on its front page of the first black man to become head of a FTSE 100 company. It's the Prudential, so the headline says it's a promotion. More news and sport through the day on guardian.co.uk.
Barack Obama made history last night by becoming the first sitting American president to appear on a TV chat show. His appearance on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno came amid mounting anger at bonuses worth $165 million paid to executives of AIG. They received the bonuses after the troubled insurer was bailed out by the American taxpayer to the tune of $173 billion. Obama's Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, is under intense pressure for failing to stop the bonus payments. Well, last night the president took the opportunity to be heard by millions of Americans to defend Geithner. Oliver Berkman reports from Washington.
I'm excited. I'm honored to introduce my first guest, the 44th President of the United States. Please welcome President Barack Obama.
There was certainly a lot of anticipation about this appearance. It's just not something that presidents do in office, appearing on these kinds of late night comedy shows. It's much less of a thing that's done than with British prime ministers. So there was a lot of speculation about how it would go. Obama had a big challenge, which was to simultaneously lighten the mood of a very angry nation, but at the same time impress upon everybody how serious he was with his economic recovery plans.
Here's the dirty little secret, though. Most of the stuff that got us into trouble was perfectly legal. And that is a sign of how much we've got to change our laws.
The line he took on the economic situation and the banking crisis was very much to recognize people's anger, especially about the story of the week, the AIG bonuses, but at the same time to say that this was part of a bigger cultural problem. It was the fact that these people could have expected the bonuses in the first place, given what they'd done or failed to do, that was the problem, rather than this specific amount of money. So he was quite cleverly at the same time saying to viewers, I feel your pain, but sort of deflecting attention in a way from the specific story to the systemic problems that he says his plans are going to help resolve.
The immediate bonuses that went to AIG are a problem, but the larger problem is we've got to get back to an attitude where people know enough is enough, and people have a sense of responsibility, and if we can get back to those values that built America, then I think we're going to be okay.
Well, you know, it's interesting, when you said...
There was one comment towards the end of this interview that could come to be seen as a pretty serious gaffe that will come back to haunt Obama. After the economic talk had finished and Leno turned the subject to sports, Obama described how he'd been practicing bowling in the White House and that he'd bowled 129, which is a poor score. And Leno sarcastically congratulated him. And Obama could be heard say, it's like the Special Olympics or something.
I've been practicing bowling.
Really? Really?
I bowled a 129.
Oh, no, that's very good. Yeah. Oh, that's very good, Mr. President.
This is like Special Olympics or something.
That's very good.
Listen, I'm making progress on the bowling.
In the moments after this had been recorded in Burbank at the studios, Obama's deputy press secretary was putting out a statement to reporters saying that Obama is fully supportive of the Special Olympics and thinks it's an excellent thing. We'll have to see whether that becomes something that will make Obama wish he'd never made this appearance in the first place.
I do think in Washington it's a little bit like American Idol, except everybody is Simon Cowell.
Wow.
This was a really good virtuoso performance in the sense that he managed to get in an enormous amount of fairly high-level economic stuff into this context, this format, TV format, that where you wouldn't necessarily expect it to work. The question is whether that will have the effect that he wants it to have. His aim with this appearance was to talk to a demographic that he wouldn't necessarily reach through the cable news channels, and we'll also have to see whether that Special Olympics gaffe comes to overshadow the rest of this appearance.
We're going to get a dog. I'm going to have a lot of fun with it. You know, they say if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog.
Exactly. So.
Well, Mr. President, I must say this has been one of the best nights of my life. Thank you very much, sir. The President of the United States. You're right,
Oliver Berkman, and there's full coverage of Obama's TV interview at guardian.co.uk/America. Also on The Guardian's website today, Julian Borgia, our diplomatic editor, on Afghanistan. A majority of Afghans support the presence of foreign troops, but he says there are signs that the welcome is wearing thin in the absence of results. Guardian.co.uk/Afghanistan to read what he says. Michael Sheen, the actor who's played Tony Blair, Kenneth Williams, and David Frost so convincingly, talks to us about his new role as the great Brian Clough at guardian.co.uk/film. And Simon Jenkins argues that the towers of Dubai will become casualties not of human greed, but of architectural folly. At guardian.co.uk/comment is free to have your say. The Austrian engineer who kept his daughter enslaved for 24 years, who raped her thousands of times and fathered seven of her children, is to spend the rest of his life behind bars. Joseph Fritzl received the maximum sentence after admitting negligent murder, enslavement, incest, rape, coercion and false imprisonment. Kate Connolly is in St. Pölten in Austria. She says Fritzl will serve his sentence in a psychiatric institution.
We understand that he will spend the next few nights in the prison cell where he's been for the last 11 months in St. Pölten before being taken to a prison in Vienna where he will be assessed. They will basically check or test how open he is to therapy, whether therapy can actually help him. We heard the day before yesterday in court a psychiatrist saying that he has a severe personality disorder, and that will be what the court will want or what the prison will want to decide as to whether that can be treated, as to where he will then go, whether it be a psychiatric institute or a prison with a wing which is able to deal with prisoners who have special needs like his.
Did Fritzl's last-minute confession of guilt and expression of remorse make any difference to his sentence?
No, it didn't. The judge, Andrea Humer, said that his crimes were really too grave for it to have made any difference at all. She said the gravity was the length of time, the 24 years that he had kept his daughter locked up, the number of times he had raped her, that was, we believe, over 3,000 times, the number of children he fathered with her, seven, and then there was the one charge that had been a sticking point throughout the trial, but which he then admitted his guilt to, which was the murder charge of one of his sons who died in 1996 because he failed to get medical support for him.
As you say, this unimaginable cruelty lasted for 24 years. What questions are now being asked in Austria about the failure of social services to see what was going on?
Well, those questions seem to be being asked more by the foreign journalists who have been here, much to the chagrin of the Austrian press, it has to be said. Much of the Austrian press very much feeling that Austria is in the dock over this trial, and rather than just Mr. Fritzl. Of course, though there are many questions to be asked about the authorities. This man had a conviction for rape at the time where his daughter went missing in 1984, and he had also had a string of other offences, sexual offences, and exposing himself to women, attempted rape. Yet, when his daughter went missing and he told authorities in 1984 that she had run off to a sect, nobody thought to question his story. And there's also the fact that then when, over the years, his daughter allegedly, or he reported, had left three of her children on his doorstep, unable to cope. In fact, he had brought them up from the cellar where she had given birth to them. The authorities again allowed him to go ahead and foster and adopt the children without questioning whether he really was the right person for this, and indeed checking out whether his story was real. So many questions that remain to be asked. The question is whether that will actually happen now, whether this process will happen now that he is behind bars.
Kate Connolly reporting. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the socialite Dasha Zhukova on Moscow's biggest ever contemporary art exhibition.
Of course we're affected, as we heavily rely on corporate sponsorship and private sponsorship. We're affected by the crisis as anyone else. So yeah, we've had to make cutbacks.
But first, the High Court has upheld a gagging order preventing The Guardian from publishing on its website internal memos about alleged tax avoidance by Barclays Bank. The documents came from a whistleblower at Barclays who passed them to the Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesman Vince Cable. The Guardian argued that the public should know the full extent of the bank's attempts to avoid tax, especially since so much taxpayers' cash has been spent keeping the banks going.
Next month, G20 leaders meet in London, and they'll be discussing how they can crack down on tax avoidance. The Guardian's investigations editor, David Lee, has seen the documents.
The seven documents in question are an account in some detail of a number of tax avoidance schemes by a division of Barclays Bank called the Structured Capital Markets Division, which it appears spends its time doing complicated transactions to save tax from various authorities.
And why did The Guardian believe it had the right to publish these documents on its website?
We believe that these documents are the most important insight yet into the elaborate tax avoidance schemes which Britain's banks, and not just Barclays, carry out. This is at a time when Britain's banks are dependent on the UK taxpayer to be bailed out, to be rescued from bringing the economy to the point of collapse. So, as Royal Bank of Scotland said, it wouldn't be right for them to be seen to be picking the taxpayer's pocket with one hand while taking their money with the other.
And why was it in the public interest, according to The Guardian, that the full contents of these documents should be disclosed?
You can't have a proper debate about what the banks are up to unless you see what it is exactly that they're up to. One of the things that emerged was that the revenue, HM Revenue and Customs, had never seen a full detailed account of these transactions. The bank had disclosed to them certain limited details, but quite a lot had been blacked out.
But earlier this week, in the middle of the night, the documents had to be taken down from The Guardian's website just hours after they'd been published there.
Big City lawyers, Freshfields, who were one of the lawyers who advised the banks on their tax avoidance schemes, woke up a judge in the middle of the night and got an injunction at 2:30 in the morning, forcing The Guardian to take down the documents from its website. And we've been in court fighting this ever since.
But the High Court's now ruled that The Guardian didn't accept The Guardian's argument that the documents was in the public interest for us to publish them, and it's upheld the gagging order.
The judge said that really The Guardian was going too far in publishing the full, unexpurgated, unedited version of these documents. We are in a very peculiar situation, however, because the judge also didn't accept that the confidentiality no longer exists in these documents because they have become available to what are called other public sources.
Vince Cable, the Lib Dems Treasury spokesman, has passed these documents to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs and to the Financial Services Authority. What happens now?
The Revenue have got to decide whether they are going to pursue Barclays. Now they understand fully the intricate details of the planning that Barclays has been engaged in. It's possible that they won't, because the Revenue are outgunned, outmanoeuvred, understaffed, and 2 or 3 years ago they did a deal with Barclays, it would appear, under which, in return for Barclays handing over, say, £300 million of back tax, which is chicken feed in their terms, the Revenue agreed not to pursue them anymore, and Barclays said it would volunteer details of all its future schemes. Result is it hands over van loads of more or less incomprehensible details, and a handful of overstretched investigators at the Revenue basically aren't on top of it.
G20 leaders meet in London very soon. What are the prospects that there'll be some kind of deal to crack down on tax avoidance?
As the world economy crashes, everybody is very keen to crack down suddenly on tax avoidance. They realise that governments are being deprived of tax revenue at a time when taxes for everybody else are going to have to go up. And they also realise that the reckless behaviour by the banks and financial institutions has brought down the world economy. And part of that reckless behaviour has been using billions of pounds, swilling around billions of pounds of capital and the best brains they can hire in order to devise complicated schemes to basically cheat national exchequers out of tax revenue.
David Lee. Back in January, George Monbiot wrote a column in The Guardian in which he claimed that owning an Aga cooker was incompatible with a green lifestyle. In fact, an Aga produces 35% more than the total CO2 production of the average UK home. The campaign against Aga starts here, he declared. Well, the company claims that Agas are efficient, and now the chief executive of Aga Rangemaster, William McGrath, has taken part in a face-to-face debate with Monbiot. And you can hear the full discussion tomorrow at guardian.co.uk/environment and read what they said in tomorrow's paper. In this excerpt, Monbiot questions McGrath about the environmental cost of producing an Aga.
I think the basic smelting iron ore, and then we clearly produce them. But in relation to the total spend, the amount of carbon dioxide is actually quite modest. The bigger figure to look at, which is the fair.
So how much is it?
I think it's in terms of carbon dioxide production per unit, it's probably something around. I should think it's around 15 tons of carbon. I should
15 tons, yeah, one so, five tons. Right. Now, so if you look the cement at, required to build an average British home produces 5 tons of carbon dioxide. We're talking about roughly the total amount of CO2 required to construct a home, 15 tons of carbon dioxide. That's a staggering amount.
Hang on. You're a great user of the word staggering. Can I check in terms of the unit per arga, where I think the numbers are much more relevant, I think, is it on the ongoing use of carbon dioxide in the home, where, as we all know, and this is a figure, unfortunately, you got so wrong in your original article, so the average home was using 1.5 tonnes, when actually, as you know, it's actually 6, or average four oven is 7.5.
I'd just like to point out that I was the one who requested the correction, having found that the Parliamentary Select Committee document that I was using for the average home emissions had actually got it wrong.
That's fine. But as we well know, the answer is six tons, 7.5 tons for 7.5 tons for a four-person home. The arga, the output of the carbon dioxide emission from an arga, we would think it depends on which version you're using, but it'd be something like 3.5 tons.
George Monbiot and William McGrath, and we'll be publishing a longer version of their discussion tomorrow at guardian.co.uk/audio. A quick mention now for the podcast's new presence on Twitter. You can follow the show's progress at twitter.com/guardiandaily. Mike Tyson became heavyweight boxing champion of the world when he was just 20 years old, and for 3 years he was unbeaten. But in 1992, 2 years after losing his first fight, he served 3 years in jail after being convicted of rape. He regained his title after that, but once again threw it away, and has since been in further trouble with alcohol and drugs. Well, now there's a documentary about his life called Simply Tyson. The Guardian's Simon Hattonstone asked Mike Tyson if, looking back at his life, he missed the drama.
I was addicted to drama at one particular time in my life where I couldn't focus without it. I've learned to become pretty content at this moment of my life. I'm sure there's more to my life I'll find out and get to learn about. But at this particular stage right now, I'm pretty cool.
And what about the addictions? Have they, you know, kind of the drink and the drugs? Is that, do you feel you're beating that?
No, I don't never beat that. You know, that's got to be to the day I die job. You know, that's an inside job. That has nothing to do with anything else. That's something that's just a disease in which I've received hereditarily. I'm not ashamed of who I am.
I think that's what's brilliant about the film, the complexity of it, because it's no whitewash, is it?
I understand we have to sell a certain way. I got to be sold a certain way, but I'm not afraid of anything that I've ever done in my life. You know what I mean? I know who I am. That's after all this journey in my life, at this point, I know who I am, and I'm cool with who I am. I'm cool with who I am.
And has it taken you a long time to get to that stage? And do you think this film has helped you get to that stage?
I don't know what this film has done, because I've had enough. The film has never been shown in a worldwide stage or a collective stage, far as the public's concerned. You know, I don't know. I just I believe it's a great film. You know, I believe my director's a great director, and I just wish the best for the film.
Mike Tyson talking to Simon Hattonstone. And you can read Simon's interview with Mike Tyson tomorrow in The Guardian or at guardian.co.uk/weekend. Despite the art market taking a big hit as a result of the global recession, Moscow's biggest ever contemporary art exhibition opened last night. The show features work by 32 artists, including Jeff Koons, Cindy Sherman and Bill Viola, all from the collection of the French entrepreneur François Pinault. Dasha Zhukova, partner of the Chelsea football club owner Roman Abramovich, previewed the show at the huge Garage Centre for Contemporary Culture, which she founded last year. She told The Guardian's Moscow correspondent, Tom Parfit, why she was undaunted by the financial crisis.
I'm really excited to have this exhibition as the second one that we hold in the garage for several reasons. The first one being that I think the Moscow public needs, in a way, an introduction to contemporary art. And I think that doing a group show is a really great, you know, stepping stone. So we opened with a Russian artist, which was Ilya and Emilia Kabakov. And then I just really wanted to show the audience the different types of contemporary art and artists that exist and, the, you know, the mediums they work in. I think these are really leading examples of such work. So this was really a big reason why we decided to do this.
You were recently named the chief editor of Pop, a famous fashion magazine.
Yes.
How will you have enough time to edit that and also to keep going with the garage?
Well, Pop is a biennial, and what I hope to do in Pop will have a lot to do with what I'm doing at the garage, because I do hope to introduce a large art element to the magazine, culture, absolutely, a lot more literature. I mean, I think these things really go hand in hand.
How do you think a show like this affects and informs Russian art, the Russian art scene?
Well, I think, you know, anything you're exposed to, whether consciously or subconsciously, affects, you know, your thought process and your, I guess, your vision. So I think that as a lot of these works and artists have never previously been shown in Moscow, it'll just be something extra for the artists to see. I mean,
can you tell us about which your favorite works are here? What do you like
most?
I hate
that question.
Oh, sorry.
I love all the works, some more other than others, I don't know, let's say. But if I were to pick one, I really love the Flavin corridor at the end. I think it's really, it turned out really well.
Dasha, I think you said that there were some quite explicit works or images that she decided not to include in the exhibition.
No, that's not what I said. You must be referring to an interview I did yesterday. Yes. What I said is, when we select works for the garage, we have to keep in mind that we have a lot of children coming through because we are still a family center. So this is one of the considerations.
Some of your commercial sponsors must be hurting quite badly right now. Does
yes.
that affect the garage at all?
Of course we're affected, as we heavily rely on corporate sponsorship and private sponsorship. We're affected by the crisis as anyone else. So yeah, we've had to make cutbacks.
And what kind of cutbacks do you mean? Less ambitious projects for the future? Or?
Perhaps less expensive exhibitions. I wouldn't use the word ambitious, but perhaps, yes, we have to really consider that aspect when choosing the artists and works we want to bring here.
Dasha Zhukova talking to Tom Parfit. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard, Tim Mabey and Andy Duckworth in Washington. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.